Thanks for listening to the teaching podcast of Bridgepoint Church. Stay tuned after the podcast for a short message, but for now, let's jump right in.
Good morning again. Today's a very special day here at Bridgepoint. You know it's a special day when I got my closed-toed shoes on, right? Like, we got to be ready for today. It is our Above and Beyond Sunday, so in just a few moments, if you consider Bridgepoint your home church, we're about to give financially above and beyond our normal tithes and offerings, and we've been talking about this for a month now, asking you to pray simply, God, what would you have us give? Again, I'm a big believer. I just want to do what Scripture says. It says, give what you have decided in your heart beforehand to give. So we're not going to, you know, show pictures of animals that are injured, or we're not manipulating anybody's heartstrings today. But if you walked in, you did not get one of these envelopes, you would just raise your hand and our ushers will be around to give you one of these. You need one per family, because inside that envelope is a card. The card says, what's one thing I'm thankful for in 2023? What's one thing I'm believing God for in 2024? And in just a moment, along with our gifts, we're going to all give that card together. And really, it's out of gratitude for all that God has done. Now, I know there may be some of you here today, maybe you're visiting for the first time, you've been here a couple times, and you're thinking, great, I picked Financial Sunday to be the Sunday I visited church. And listen, if that's you, we're so glad you're here. Let me alleviate any of your fears. We have no expectation on that. Listen, we don't have a goal other than if Bridgepoint is your home church, we would love for 100% participation in some way, even if that just means turning in that card. We really believe this is a moment we can all come in together. But if you are a guest, I actually couldn't think of a better Sunday for you to check out Bridgepoint, because I think you can tell a lot about a person, about a family, about a business, about a church, based on the way they use their resources, especially their money. And so today you really get a glimpse at who Bridgepoint is and what we're all about. And so in just a moment, we're going to have an opportunity to give. And I will tell you, you know, there's some Sundays that those are preaching Sundays where I get to get up here and preach and get all animated. And then there's some Sundays that are teaching Sundays where I get my whiteboard and I get to draw pictures and try to dive deep. And this Sunday is neither one of those. Honestly, this Sunday, I'm not giving the sermon. You are. Your giving is the message today. Your giving is the message not only to our church, but to the world, that we're trusting Jesus in this moment. So all I have today are a few devotional thoughts that I just want to share as we kind of prep for this important moment as a church. And as I was thinking and praying through what God would have me share today, this story came to mind from back when I was in sales. Before I was in ministry, I was in lighting sales. I sold light bulbs to businesses, all right? So not the coolest sales job in the world, but I loved it. And company was great, but one thing that stands out to me, when you are in sales, one of the biggest things that you're going to be graded on is your ability to generate new business. So there's like a minimum expectation of how many new customers you should get a month. And in my business, it was 3 to 4, but I had the privilege of starting about 3 months after my good friend, who was averaging 9 to 12 new customers a month. So I felt like the pressure was on. So I do a month of training, my first month on my own. Halfway through the month, guess how many customers I had? 0. So I'm desperate. I'm like ready to pay somebody to take these light bulbs so I could get a new customer. So I'll never forget, I go up to this building and I sold to the building engineer, the maintenance guy. So you go around the dock, you knock on the door, you found ways to sneak into buildings. I will tell you that. And so I find this maintenance guy and I said, hey, my name's Matt. He said, my name's Sam. So I go through my whole spiel. Can I help you? He's like, sure. So we walk around the building and I'm like taking pictures. I'm looking for ways I can add value. And I said, hey, can I go home, kind of work up a few things and come back tomorrow and make a little presentation? He said, absolutely. So I go home that night and I'm seeing what solutions do I have and how much money can I save? And you won't have to replace this bulb for that long, and get my presentation together. I go back the next day. He's like, awesome, glad to see you. I go through my presentation. He's like, man, this looks good, but can we do anything about the price? And so I'm like, all right, give me till tomorrow. I'll figure out something on the price. In the meantime, what are like 2 or 3 of your most commonly used bulbs? Like, I'm pulling out every trick I know. So I go back and I come back the next day. He said, I would love to have this meeting over Waffle House. Is that possible? And I was like, yep, you know, hop in my car. We drove around the corner. Now listen, when somebody's taking you out to eat, it's not like he's getting, you know, a couple eggs. He got the all-star special. He got like the whole fixings and everything. I go through the whole presentation. He says, man, Matt, this looks great. I would buy from you, but I'm not the person who makes the decision. And I thought, I wasted 3 days and I bought enough food to feed an army for you, and you're not even the one to make decisions. He's like, yeah, it's my boss, Dennis. So I learned a very valuable sales lesson that day. The first question you always ask is, are you the decision maker? Are you the one who is in charge? Because the reality is, if you don't know who's in charge, you could waste a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of effort. And that's not just true in sales. That's true in our life. If we don't know who's in charge, you can waste your time. If you don't know who's in charge, you will waste your finances. If you don't know who is in charge, you can spend your time doing a whole lot of stuff that isn't accomplishing any good. And so today, I really want us to wrestle with the question, who's in charge? In fact, I would venture to say that when we look at the Christmas story, that is the big question the Christmas story is forcing us to ask. Who is in charge? Now, if I could be honest for just a moment, not that I would lie to you, but as a pastor, maybe there's other pastors who are more spiritual than I am, so maybe it's just a me thing, but like, I hate teaching at Christmas time. Like, I love the Christmas season, but you know why I hate teaching? Because you've heard the story a million times, right? Like, you've seen Charlie Brown, you've read the kids' books, you've told the story, you know the Christmas story. So how on earth am I supposed to come up with anything new or interesting? So let me lower the expectations today. I'm not trying to teach you anything new. I'm not trying to tell you anything you haven't heard before. I'm really just trying to remind us of a few things and point out that when it comes to Christmas, we have to wrestle with the question, who's in charge? Because when Jesus was born, it was at the time where the Roman Empire was rapidly expanding. In fact, we have a picture here of how big the Roman Empire was at the time of Jesus. It's that whole red area. So you can see how big this place is. Now, this is before cell phones, all right? So they couldn't just pick up the phone and call and manage long distances. So Caesar's ruling over this empire. He has to appoint these local kings. So cue a man named Herod. Herod's dad had dabbled in politics, and Herod himself had this spice trade, and he thought, you know what would really help my business? If I got into politics, right? Good thing a lot's changed in the last 2,000 years. We don't have to deal with that anymore. So Herod develops this plan. He's going to go to Rome, and he offers this gift, or we might say bribe, to Caesar. And Caesar's impressed, but not that impressed. So he says, Herod, I'll appoint you as one of these kings, but I'm going to give you the area nobody wants. In fact, there had been a high turnover of kings in this region, because the key people kept revolting. The people who lived there were the Jewish people. And they had this idea in their mind that they were God's chosen people, and that because of that, they should sovereignly rule themselves. And so they're actually in the middle of a revolt. The first thing Herod has to do, he's given this land, he has to round up an army and go in and take back the land he was supposed to rule. And so from that moment on, Herod began to rule with an iron fist. Now remember, he got into politics to increase his wealth. He had the spice trade. And you know what would really help with that is if he could have some kind of port in his region. The problem is there was no naturally occurring coastline for a port, suitable for a port. So you know what Herod did? He reshaped the coastline. In fact, he and his engineers developed a way to actually dredge out the bottom of the sea to make it a deep water port. They even developed a new technique to help cement solidify under the water, and he created what would become the biggest port in the entire Roman Empire. And because he was trying to curry favor with Caesar, he named it after him. It was called Caesarea Maritima. We actually have a picture of what that harbor would have looked like. Now, not only that, but he covers the whole thing in marble. Now, if you go there today, the marble won't be there, but there was so much marble that over the years, it's been grinded in. The sand itself still has that marble in it. This becomes a pretty significant place, even in the New Testament. Peter goes there, Paul goes there. You can read about that in the book of Acts. But this was considered one of the wonders of the world. Herod didn't stop there. He also built this fortress into the side of a mountain or a cliff called Masada. And we have a picture of Masada as well. And after he died, they discovered that he had 100 years worth of food stored in this fortress. So not only did he have 100 years worth of food, he figured out a way to preserve it and store it in the Middle East. But perhaps his most crowning achievement was something called the Herodium. It was a fortress he built. After one uprising in his region, he decided, you know what I really need? I need a fortress on top of a mountain. Just one problem. There was no mountain where he wanted to build his fortress. So you know what he did? He literally built a mountain. We have a picture of them excavating the Herodium. He built that mountain. He had it built. In fact, he didn't just do that. He has this three-tiered kind of fortress. The bottom level was a pool that was the biggest pool in the Middle East. It was so big that there was an island in the middle of it with a building. And if you wanted to get to that building, you had to get there by boat. I mean, we're talking a massive pool. The middle layer was his court where he would do all of his business or political dealings. And the top layer was his living quarters. In fact, this was so impressive that there was a phrase that started to circulate at that time that said, Herod has the vision to move mountains. Not to mention the resources and the manpower, but he has the vision to move mountains, which I love because there's a point in Jesus' ministry when he's talking with his disciples at the Mount of Olives where they could have been within eyesight of this. They would have looked up and Jesus said, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move, and it will be thrown into the sea. See, Herod might have vision to move mountains, but your faith can move mountains. Now, growing up, I always thought that, man, if you just believe enough, then God's gonna move the mountains in your life. But that's not what Jesus is saying. Because for Jesus, faith wasn't belief. Faith was a way of life. It's like being faithful to Jesus. What he's saying is, Herod might have the vision to build mountains, but if you're faithful to me, you're gonna see these mountains fall. Kings and kingdoms are gonna pass away, but King Jesus will reign forever. Who is in charge? Now, Herod has all of this acclaim and glory and fame, but he wants to legitimize his rule over the Jewish people. So he marries a Jewish princess named Mariamne. Now, to give you an idea of where kind of Herod's mindset was, he did love this woman. And when she died, he actually had her encased in honey, like think Han Solo and carbonite, so that he could go and visit her and see her. Okay, so maybe not the most rational human being. But he also married her as she was a Jewish princess. And if she was a Jewish princess and he was her husband, that made him king of the Jews. And he would do anything it took to protect his kingship, including any threats from his own family. He's known for killing a number of people, but I think one short story that I think would kind of underscore this whole thing. At the end of Herod's life, he was dying from what doctors now believe was syphilis, and his body was literally rotting. The stench was so strong that attendants could only be in the room for a few moments at a time before they got sick and had to leave. And one of the attendants supposedly said to Herod, "You know, when you die, no one will shed a tear." So Herod says, I can change that. And he rounds up some of the most beloved and influential people. He has them held captive in the Colosseum and gives word that when he finally dies, they're to slaughter those people. Because if people won't cry for Herod, they'll cry for them. And people will shed tears on the day that I die. Well, apparently the doctor believes that he's died, so they share the news. So Herod's son immediately becomes king, and he puts a stop to that whole thing. Unfortunately, there was some miscommunication and Herod had just passed out. When he came to and discovered what his son had done, he was furious. So he holds a dinner party and invites a lot of powerful people over, attaches his son to a strangulation device, and with each passing course, they tighten it just a little more and they time it up so his son breathes his last breath as they finish dessert. So, not a nice guy. Now, he wants to maintain power. He wants to do all these projects. He's trying to etch his name in history. How is he going to pay for all this? Well, how does the government pay for anything? Taxes, other people's money, right? Now, throughout the Roman Empire, the history, usually the tax rate was around 70 to 80%. But what scholars believe is at the time of Jesus' birth, the tax rate was over 90%. So you have Herod taking over 90% of stuff from other people to fund his efforts, to fund Roman efforts. And so to kind of make it up to the people, he built this ornate temple for the Jewish people. But before they could enter in, he had attached a giant golden eagle at the entryway, which was the Roman symbol. Almost as if to say, hey, here's this nice temple I built for you. You can go and worship your little god, but don't forget who's really in charge. It's me. Don't forget, you pay your taxes to me. Don't forget, you're only here because I've decided I'm really in charge. And it's under that setting that Jesus is born. Now, we've already established, you know the story, Mary, Joseph, the manger, the whole thing. So you know that. We're going to skip ahead 2 years, all right? To Matthew chapter 2, Jesus is now about 2 years old. We're going to pick up this morning, Matthew chapter 2, starting in verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of King Herod, wise men from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star at its rising and have come to worship him. All right, so let's set the scene. Herod, chilling in his palace. He's in his court, maybe overlooking his giant pool. And all of a sudden, these wise men come in and said, hey, we've heard that the king of the Jews has been born. Now, this is interesting because Herod is supposed to be the king of the Jews. And so all of a sudden, we're really faced with, okay, who is the real king of the Jews? Who's really in charge? The other question we got to ask ourselves is, who are these wise men? Because we probably have certain images in our mind from nativity scenes or the California Raisins animated Christmas special. Anybody remember that? Just me. All right. Okay. It's claymation. It was awesome. But you get this picture that they're kings. They have all this great garb on, and there's three of them traveling on camels through the desert. Please forget all of that. All right. Because these were not we three kings. They weren't kings at all. In fact, we don't even know how many there were. Spoiler alert, they're going to bring three gifts. But we don't know that there were three of them. In fact, the earliest Christian tradition said there were 12 of them. So who are they? The Bible doesn't tell us a lot, but what we know from historical sources is that in about 66 AD, the Roman emperor wanted to expand into Persia. And so he sends a group over and says, submit to Caesar or die. Now, both Herod and the king of Persia knew that Rome did not want to fight a war on the Eastern Front. Persia didn't want to suffer any casualties. So the king of Persia sends back this message and says, hey, listen, what if we pay you tribute? You can say you rule over us, but you leave us alone and we just do our own thing. Sound good? And the Roman emperor said, that's fine, but I still need you to come here and sign a treaty so I can save face and say that we won this battle. So what the historical records tell us is that the king of Persia sent emissaries called magi over to sign this treaty on his behalf. So the wise men, the word the Bible uses, is they were magi. So who were they? They were political emissaries. They were representatives of the king who would go and do his business on his behalf. So they are here to pay homage to this newborn king of the Jews. This is a pretty big deal. And notice Herod's response in verse 3. It says, when King Herod heard this, he was deeply disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. So Herod sees these emissaries. They're here to see the king of the Jews, and they don't think that he's the king of the Jews, and this disturbs him. Not just him, but all Jerusalem as well. Now, do we really think that in Jerusalem, these people who are taxed 90%, that there wasn't at least a few people who were happy? Listen, this is kind of the way of saying, if we said everybody in Washington is corrupt, you know, we're talking about people in power. We're not talking about like the good people who just happen to live in Washington. So this is Herod, and everyone who has benefited from Herod's reign is disturbed because they know there's a different king of the Jews. And when he rules and reigns, everything's going to be different. Now, I can't say for certain, but I don't think that it's a stretch to say that Herod, because he married a Jewish princess, would have probably been somewhat familiar with Jewish prophecies. Now, there's a story in Numbers chapter 24 that involves a talking donkey that I don't have time to get into today. So if you have that question, feel free to text it in, and maybe we can talk about it at the end. But in that whole story, there comes out this prophecy about one day when God is going to set everything right. And in Numbers chapter 24, verse 18, it says, Edom will become a possession. Seir will become a possession of its enemies, but Israel will be triumphant. One who comes from Jacob will rule. He will destroy the city. Survivors. So notice this prophecy here says that one day the kingdom of Edom will be conquered by a Jewish king who comes from the line of Jacob, and Israel will prosper. Interesting tidbit, Herod is from Edom. So could it be that he realizes that one day there's going to be a king who's going to topple the king of Edom, and that new king's kingdom will be the ultimate one that rules and reigns? Herod sees Jesus as a threat, because he knows his kingdom and Jesus' kingdom are very different. I mean, we can look as Jesus grows into a man and he begins his ministries. The two kingdoms could not be more diametrically opposed to one another. Herod spends his entire life seeking power, influence, wealth, and comfort. And Jesus spends his entire life sacrificing power, wealth, influence, and comfort. Herod kills his political enemies. Jesus dies for his enemies. Herod manipulates and oppresses other people. Jesus goes around setting people free. Herod does everything for himself. And Jesus, even though he was God, did not consider that something that he could abuse. but set that aside to serve the other people. There are two different kingdoms at work here, the kingdom of Herod or the kingdom of Jesus. And the question we're forced to ask is the same question the Magi had to answer. And that's this: who's really in charge? Now, notice in the New Testament, we use phrases sometimes like, want to invite Jesus into our heart, and we sing about Jesus being the king of my heart. And listen, nowhere in the New Testament do they say, listen, we want Jesus to make you the king of your life. We want Jesus to make you the king of your heart. Do you know the message of the New Testament is simply this: Jesus is king. Will you just live like he's in charge? Like, there's no debate. Jesus is king. He's reigning over his kingdom. The question is, will we live like Jesus is in charge, or will we live like Herod is in charge? It reminds me, like, across the political spectrum, right? People will be like, Donald Trump's not my president. Joe Biden's not my president. I'm like, no, yeah, they're both your president, right? Like, whether you wanted them to or not, you might say, no, I'm the king of my own kingdom. No, Jesus is king. Whether you want to admit that or not, that's up to you. And so the question is, will we live like Jesus is king? Now, I'm going to make an assumption, and this may be a broad assumption, I might be wrong, but you showed up to church on a Sunday when it was raining. So I'm going to assume that probably most of us in this room are trying to figure out how to live life like Jesus is king. We know that oftentimes it feels like Herod is king, but we want to live like Jesus is king. So what do you do if Jesus is really the king? But what did the Magi do? Matthew chapter 2, jump down to verse 11. It says, entering the house, which, by the way, think about the whiplash. They go from the Herodium, this like great ornate thing. Now they're walking into a Jewish family living in poverty, and they're walking into their house. So entering the house, they saw the child Mary, his mother, and falling to their knees, they worshiped him. Probably a better translation is they paid homage to him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So get this picture. Political emissaries, like the other side of the world, walk into this poor Jewish house. They see this baby. They kneel down to pay homage to this baby as king of the Jews and give gold, frankincense, and myrrh. There's been a lot of discussion. What do the gifts mean? You know, some people say, well, the gold is a kingly gift. So that represents Jesus as king. And the frankincense was used in the temple as part of the worship. And so this represents Jesus as priest. And the myrrh was actually used during burial process to cover up the decomposing body. So kind of weird, like show up to the baby shower with embalming fluid. I don't know if that's the best gift. Or maybe it's this idea that Jesus knows where his life is headed. Or it could be that this is something that relates to the prophets of that day. And so is it that these gifts mean that Jesus is prophet, priest, and king? Regardless of exactly what it means, we could all agree on this. These are all gifts fit for royalty. See, the Magi believed that Jesus was king, and their response was to give him gifts. And so today, I just want us to ponder, what gifts could we give Jesus? Because if you think about Christmas, kind of weird. Imagine if I'm having a birthday party and I invite you all over and you all exchange gifts with one another and nobody gives me a gift and we leave the party, and I would think that is the weirdest birthday party ever. Yeah, that's what we do every Christmas. Happy birthday, Jesus. We're all going to give presents to each other and we'll see you next year. Like, it's kind of strange, but I get it. Because, you know, it's been said men are hard to shop for. Okay, we could maybe grant that. And then what do you get the God who has everything? I mean, what gifts could we possibly offer Jesus? Listen, Jesus doesn't need anything from us, but I think we all have things that we could offer to Jesus. And so I just want to offer four quick thoughts. What are some things we could offer to Jesus this Christmas? The first one is this. I think we could offer him our trust. Our trust that he actually is king. See, there's a difference between belief and trust. Back in the late 1800s, there was a guy named Charles Blondin. He was a great tightrope walker. And he kind of got fame for walking on a tightrope across Niagara Falls. He's 1,100 feet up in the air. And I guess that eventually kind of became his shtick. So he did it one time and got a lot of press. So like he did another time, like, you know, going backwards, and then did another time with a wheelbarrow, and another time with the manager on his back. That manager's working for his money, by the way. Like, he's crawled that whole thing. So apparently the way the story goes, and I don't know how much is legend, how much is true. So let me just preface that. But this big crowd had gathered to watch him cross Niagara Falls. And so he said, "How many of you believe that I can cross Niagara Falls?" And the whole crowd goes wild. "We believe you could do it." It's like, "How many of you think I could go blindfolded?" "Yeah, we believe you can do it." "How many of you think I could go with this wheelbarrow?" "I believe you could do it." "All right, who wants to get in the wheelbarrow?" Dead silence. See, there's a difference between "we believe you can do it," but then "I'm going to trust that you're going to do it." And my biggest fear is that for too many of us, our lives are stood on the sideline cheering Jesus on, saying how much we believe in him, but we actually haven't put our trust in him. Are we actually trusting him with our hopes and our dreams? Are we trusting him with our career decisions? Are we trusting him with our family and our finances? And do we trust that Jesus is king even when it feels like Herod is? Because let's be honest, we talked about this last week. It doesn't always feel like Jesus is king. Here's the thing. The Magi brought their gifts and they left. And they said, "Jesus is king." But Herod was still taxing people. Herod was still killing people. Herod was still ruling and reigning even though Jesus was king. And so we kind of live in the middle where we know Jesus is king. And one day he will topple every king and kingdom opposed to him. But in the meantime, doesn't it feel sometimes like Herod's still in charge? But will we trust Jesus? That when the world tells us to get revenge, we're going to turn the other cheek. That when the world tells us that we need to put up walls and keep people out, Jesus tells us to keep inviting people to sit down at the table. When the world tells us to live one way for ourselves, and Jesus says, "Live your life for others." When the world says, "Get all you can," and Jesus says, "It's blessed, more blessed to give than to receive." Do we trust that Jesus' way is better than Herod's way? We can give him our trust. I think another gift we can give him is we can give him our first. And I'm trying to come up with ways I can phrase this that are memorable, but really I would just say, like, could we put him first? And I was like, would we put him first? Even I think about like financial situations. I mean, I know for me, how quick am I sometimes just to buy something without even praying and saying, "God, should I buy this thing?" Like, it's not even a question that I would just decide if I need it or not, instead of saying, "God, would you want me to buy this or not?" We put him first in our family. Like, do we spend time praying for our spouse, praying for our kids? We put him first in our relationship. Do we pray for our friends? Do we help point them to others? Do we put him first in our schedule? Like, how many times have I met with people who say, "Man, I really wanted to spend time with Jesus, but the day just slipped away from me. Yeah, I really wanted to be at church, but man, my alarm didn't go off. I just didn't make it in time." Listen, do we allow our schedule to dictate our relationship with Jesus, or do we let our relationship with Jesus to dictate our schedule? Like, we're quick to put meetings on the calendar. Would we even be willing to put a meeting with Jesus on our calendar? Would we prioritize him? Would we give him our first? We can give him our trust. We can give him our first. I think we can also give him our heart. And again, I'm not talking like ooey gooey, like I'm going to pray and invite Jesus into my heart kind of thing. Really what I'm talking about is Jesus says, wherever your treasure is, that's where your heart will be. And I grew up thinking that what Jesus was saying is where your heart is, that's where your treasure is. Like, if you love somebody, you spend money on them. And while that might be true, that is not what Jesus is saying. What Jesus is saying is wherever your treasure is, that's where your heart is. When you invest in something, all of a sudden you care about it. Like, if you start investing, there are companies you've never heard of that all of a sudden you become pretty invested in those quarterly reports when they come out because they're in control of your money. You're trying to get a return on that investment. And in the same way, a lot of times we're investing in a lot of things, but we're not investing in Jesus. Here's what I know. Jesus doesn't need your money, but he does want your heart. And when we invest our finances in God's kingdom, all of a sudden that passion starts to stir. We become drawn to God and his kingdom and bringing heaven to earth. That becomes so important to who we are. And really, that's a big part of what above and beyond is. That's why we don't set financial goals, because that's not even what it is. It's about giving God our heart. And even as a church, like somebody asked me in the last service, "So does this just fund our missions for the whole year?" No. We give to missions regularly out of our budget. And just like we're giving above and beyond, as a church family, we're taking this and giving above and beyond to support other things. So what are we going to do with this? Well, as you give, whatever it is, we're going to take 50% and we're going to help our missions partners. So for example, one thing that we have been blessed to do the last couple years, there is an entire school in Africa with 120 students and teachers combined that until we started partnering with them 2 years ago, they did not have meals at school. But for the last 2 years, because of your generosity, every day those students and teachers have at least 2 warm meals while they're at school. That's something like we may never get to go to those schools, but you're blessing people. You're bringing heaven to earth. Sometimes people say, well, Matt, aren't we just meeting physical needs? Don't we need to meet spiritual needs? Listen, for Jesus, there was never a distinguishment between physical and spiritual. Like, Jesus went around healing people. That seems like a pretty physical need. He was casting out demons. That's physical and spiritual. He raised people from the dead. Pretty physical need, if you ask me. And if we're going to bring heaven to earth as we go around to do that, oftentimes it looks like meeting physical needs. We also partner with a children's home and school in Seguatepeque, Honduras, called Destino del Reino. And we've been partnering with them for years. And this is a school for the poorest of the poor. And so sometimes the only food or clothes that these kids have comes from being a part of this school. And as a church, we financially support them. We want to help them be able to hire teachers to come back year after year. But we're also sending a mission trip team over there for the second summer in a row this coming up year. In fact, next Sunday after our second service, there's an interest meeting. So if you're not committing to anything, but if you want to learn about cost and time frame and what you'll be doing and all that stuff, be there for that meeting. This is in my heart as your pastor, is that every single person in our church, at least one point in your life, would go on a mission trip like this. I know for some of you, you think that's financially impossible. Listen, we want to make sure that even through Above and Beyond, we're making that possible for people, even if you don't think that it's possible for yourself. We want to continue to support them. And then, of course, we partner with some missionaries from our church, Trey and Maddie Kaysen. They work for Global Hope Network International. And what they focus on is transformational community development, or TCD for short. I know it's a big fancy term. You don't have to remember that. But essentially, there's five areas like education, health, farming, business, that they are going to go into remote villages. And of those five areas, they're going to ask them, which one of these is most important to you? And then we want to help you be able to come up with solutions for those needs on your own. So here's maybe a distinguishing thing between them and some other places. Some places will go in and build wells for people, which, by the way, I am all for. But sometimes when they build wells for these remote villages, when the well breaks, they don't have access to replaceable parts. And the cost to get them is astronomical. So when the well breaks, it just doesn't work anymore. And because they've already got one, it might be a long time before they get a new one. What Trey and Maddie will do is they'll go into these villages, and if they want to help purify water, they help them source local resources to help figure out how to purify the water so that if something does break, number one, they know how to fix it. Number two, they can afford the replacement parts so it becomes sustainable. And they'll work on all five of those things. And when the community is kind of at a place where they're ready to be on their own, usually after 2 or 3 years, Trey and Maddie will leave, because we're not trying to create a dependence. We're helping each of these villages identify their needs and come up with their own solutions. And what I love is then they'll tell stories that the neighboring villages will say, hey, we need help too. And GH and I will say, no. Go to that first village. They'll teach you how to do this. So now you have villages helping other villages. It's an entire movement instead of one organization. And so they have this whole plan. And so I reached out to Trey and Maddie. I said, what are some things, like, again, I don't know what we're going to have available, but if we could bless you this year, what are some projects that we could tackle? And one of the things they want to do is they want to take this whole plan and they want to translate it into Mongolian. And they actually have other organizations that they partner with. They want to make it open and free, available to everyone, so that the work can continue to move on. And do you know the total cost to translate their whole business plan into Mongolian? $500. I was like, I think we might be able to help with that. But then, man, Trey and Maddie, they're awesome. They actually came to Bridgepoint. They came to a life group first, started coming to our church, and they were a part of our church family long before they worked with GH and I. But now, like, God has just elevated them in positions within Global Hope that are awesome. Maddie's in charge of their whole environmental division now. So they're going into other regions and helping them, again, with sustainable solutions to their problem. So another project they said is in Egypt, we're trying to help them with drought-resistant farming. And what we really want to do is help 20 families, and they would be able to, because once 20 families have access to that drought resistant farming, it's not those families but entire communities that get changed. I was like, man, that sounds awesome. How much is that going to cost? $500. All right, I think we might even be able to handle that. And then in India, they want to help with solar-powered street lighting and house lighting so they don't have to rely on a grid, but that they actually have renewable, sustainable sources of light. And in addition to that, they want to have drip irrigation so that throughout the year, they're able to farm in an easily reproducible way. And all of that, $1,700 to help 17 families with all of that stuff right there. Like, there's so many things. They actually want to expand their efforts into Myanmar, which I don't know if you're familiar with what's going on in Myanmar, but there's been this military conflict for quite a while. It's going to take $20,000 to fully fund it. I told him we may not be able to fully fund the whole thing, but I bet we can help with a little bit of it. It's just so awesome. We get to be a part of bringing heaven to earth in all these places. And as a little side note, just because I like to update you, Trey, actually, with GHNI, GHNI's global headquarters is located in Geneva, literally across the street from the UN. And every year, GHNI is asked to host this event for world leaders at the UN, and Trey's the one who organizes it. And I was like, this is so trippy. I saw a picture of him sitting at the end of a table with world leaders talking about this stuff that we're partnering with them on, and we're helping. And it's like, man, we're just a small church, and we know Trey and everything else, but we're able to help other people and influence people around the world when we support efforts like that, where we're bringing heaven to earth. And there's so much more about our mission partners I could say, but I'm way over on time. So just bear with me. I got one more thing I want to point out here. We're going to take 25% of this offering and put it in savings. Why do we do that? Because, you know, things like giving hope, the gifts are a lot, but there's a lot of other costs associated with it. Because those $50 gift cards we give the families, that was $1,000 this year to bless those families. There's food we're giving them. There's admin costs, material costs, all that stuff. And you know what? We were able to cover that because of last year's Above and Beyond. We were able to set aside in preparation for stuff like this. So we always want to be able to operate taking advantage of opportunities instead of saying, man, I wish we could have taken advantage of that opportunity. We want to be wise with our finances. And then the last 25% goes to an annual project. And this year, our project is a total renovation of our kids' area. That includes, like, listen, we moved into this building in January of 2020, so like perfect timing, right? One of the benefits was that whole kids' side over there, like where the baby rooms and everything were, it was one open room. Like, there was no growth tracker, it was just open space. So we were able to put some walls in, and that's been great. But the carpet in there is older than the kids who are in the room now. And so we're gonna go in, we're gonna replace all the carpet. We've got new paint that we're gonna put up. We've got these low-profile storage units. This is where I get really excited. Low-profile storage units that go on the wall so we don't take up a ton of floor space, but all of the toys and everything gets put up during class. And then at the end of the day, nice and clean, we want to put in split doors to help. So when you drop your kids off, you know, they're safe and secure. They're not going to wander out. Want to be able to put in security cameras with rolling cloud storage. Because again, when you drop your kids off with us, we want you to have the peace of mind that we are doing everything we can to keep them safe and help them fall in love with Jesus. Because here's what I know. I know the next generation, like, loves Jesus. There's a lot of times you want to say, oh man, this generation, that generation. We have students in our student ministry who are up here on Wednesday night, just a full night of worship. Like, they could have been doing anything, could have been playing video games or hanging out with friends. They're here worshiping Jesus. And they were so excited about giving hope that afterwards they moved all the chairs and put them up. And I walked in and said, we can't do that yet because we have an event here tomorrow morning. And so they put all the chairs right back out and they didn't complain. Like, listen, the next generation, I think, is primed for a move of God. And not only our students, but our kids. We have the best dream team in the world dealing with our kids. Yesterday at Giving Hope, we had a middle school student who did not want to walk in the room with the kids. And then when the mom finally went to pick her up, she did not want to leave because of how much fun she was having. So we have the dream teamers. The kids are awesome. They're having a great time even right now. But how much better would it be if we could just give the whole thing a facelift and give them new toys and everything else? That's what we want to do. And so the whole thing's divided out in phases, and we'll move at the pace of your generosity. I said before, if you told me I had $1 million, I can tell you exactly where every penny would go. So the vision's not the issue here. And listen, I'm patient. We'll just go at the pace of whatever we give. We'll fund whatever mission efforts we can. We'll do whatever part of the renovation in the kids area we can. And we'll just continue to be vision-focused people. We want to be the kind of church that's always looking forward to bringing heaven to earth. And when we give, we're not just giving our finances. What we're saying is, God, I'm investing here because I want my heart attached to your heart. I want you to have my heart. We don't have time for questions. So if you have a question, come find me in the lobby. I'll be glad to answer your question. But there is one other gift I think we could give to Jesus. This one's going to sound weird. It's our friends, okay? So I don't mean that. That sounds more creepy than I mean it to be. What I really mean is we have an opportunity to invite other people to encounter Jesus in the way that we have. Other people are like floundering in a world where Herod's in charge, and we have an opportunity to introduce them to a new king and a new kingdom and a new hope and a new joy and a new peace. As a pastor, I want to be honest, not that I would lie to you. I hate Christmas Eve services. Okay, I said it. It's out there. I feel better because normally they're at night. There's fire. You've had kids light their hair on fire before, and it's like just a lot of things can go wrong on a Christmas Eve service. And so normally I'm like dreading the Christmas Eve service. But this year, I've never been more excited about a Christmas Eve service. And yeah, maybe some of that's set there in the morning. But at Christmas Eve, I'm actually setting up what all of 2024 is going to be about for us as a church. This last year, whether you realize it or not, was all about discipleship, spiritual growth, right? Flourish. It wasn't an accident we did that. That was planned a long time ago. And I'll go ahead and tell you that in 2024, the theme for us is to have to be Jesus-centered. So on Christmas Eve, we're going to talk about what does it look like for Jesus to be at the center. And then in January, we're going to do a series. You know, I'm great with series titles. It's called The Jesus-Centered Life. And we're going to spend 6 weeks looking at what are five markers of a Jesus-centered life. Then we're going to walk through the Sermon on the Mount. How do we live this out? In August, we're going to be, this is a Jesus-centered church. What does that look like? Then we're going to go through Galatians because that's what they were working out. What does it mean to be a Jesus-centered church? It's the year of Jesus-centeredness. I'm sure at some point somebody with better marketing skills will come up with better wording for it. But I think we have a really unique opportunity this Christmas Eve. I don't know if this is true, but what I've read is it's the number one time people who would never go to any church would actually show up. I've also read that most people would show up if a friend invited them. And I never really push inviting friends to church. It's just like, maybe I'm a bad salesman for Jesus, you know? But really, I'm telling you, I think that this Christmas Eve, not because anything I'm going to say, but just the direction of our church, I think there's some people who get caught up in that flow and may look back a year from now and realize Jesus is the center of my life now because my friend invited me to be there on Christmas Eve. And so as you walked in, there were business cards on the seat. I know some of you probably thought people were saving seats. The reason I do that is because even if you just pick it up to move it, everyone will have touched the invite card before they leave today. And I want to encourage you to take that with you. Maybe there's a coworker, a friend, even a family member that you've been praying for that you know would benefit from realizing, listen, Herod isn't king, Jesus is, and there's a whole new way to live. So in just a moment, I'm going to pray and we're going to continue in worship like we do every week with the time of communion. And so as you have your communion and as you visit the prayer stations, I want you to grab your envelope. And in the envelope is the card that says, what's one thing I'm thankful for in 2023? It's one thing I'm believing God for in 2024. And then here's what I'm giving for above and beyond. Here's what I want to encourage you to do. As you wrap up your communion time, whoever you came with, friends, yourself, your family, spend a moment praying over your cards together. And whether there's a gift in here or not, like if it's just that card, here's what I'm praying for. Like let's all just go 100% all in today. And then as you feel led, you'll just leave your gift right here at the front of the stage. And that's the sermon. That's us saying, God, we're giving you our trust. We're putting you first. We're giving you our heart. We want to bring other people along the way. So all across this room, would you bow your heads and close your eyes with me? Jesus, we're so thankful that in a world where sometimes it feels like Herod is king, that we know that you're ruling and reigning. And I pray right now for those who need comfort and reassurance that you're still on your throne, that you would give it to them. I pray for each and every one of us who spent this last year cheering you on from the sideline. Today, we would get in the wheelbarrow. We would put our trust in you. That we would put you first in our schedule and in our homes. As we give these offerings, we're giving you our heart. That you would even put people on our mind that we need to bring along the way. And so in this moment, would you work and you move, and even through our offerings, you'd help us to become more like you. It's in Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for listening to the Bridgepoint Church Podcast. I hope we've shared something meaningful for you wherever you're at in your spiritual journey. Just so you know a little bit more about us, we meet on Sunday mornings in downtown Woodstock, but we also meet during the week in what we call life groups, and that's where the really good stuff happens for us. If you're becoming a regular listener of this podcast, we'd like to invite you to make it relational, just like we do during the week. Grab a Bible, invite some friends to join you, and turn this into a conversation. If you're already a regular listener and would like to support this ministry financially, you can do so by visiting us online at bpc.life and choosing the giving option that works best for you. Thanks again for listening.